Okay. I'm going to skip, I think, 368. Go to 369. Again, I'm just looking at different ways of saying this basic idea, and then we'll be looking at the implications of this basic idea. 369, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines down. During this process, the spirit becomes corporal. That goes a little bit to your question, Carol, how the spirit can become the body earlier. During this process, the spirit becomes corporal. The dead body receives a soul and takes up again the spirit that had been extracted from it. In other words, if you are fighting for your relationship, those marriage arguments are the spirit. That is the spirit, this is saying. See what I'm saying? You don't go meditate on a rooftop to be spiritual. You fight with your spouse. That is spirituality. I know. It's changing what we understand by spirit. That's one of the imports of this text. And, you know, I must say, I with the theologians I work with, it is so frustrating because you can see their dreams are filled with the spirit.
So then if somebody is got a cause and they're going and marching forth with it and battling corporate law and all this kind of stuff, that's spirituality.
If it came from the self.
Well, how do you know if it didn't come from the self? I mean, what if...
That's the big question. Is it the animus? Is it the anima? Is it the shadow? Is it the self? You really cannot tell until you look inside. I can kind of tell, you know, you develop sort of a crap detector. You can tell when people are doing a task out of the self or out of another complex. I think one of the distinguishing features is impetuosity. If there's impetuosity, it's probably out of a complex. Blaming. If there's blaming, it's probably out of a complex. With this Pali material, we'll be seeing God, mixing metaphors a little bit, God was asking him to talk about the limitations of science. When this comes up in his dreams, it is filled with religious imagery. That was to be his form of worship. Everybody has got something to do here. That's a basic premise of Jungian psychology. Everybody is born with something to do. And when you're doing it, whether it's gardening, whether it's raising children, whether it's fighting the Attorney General, whether it's fighting IBM, whether it's being an executive for IBM, whatever it is, that is your spiritual task. And that is the spiritual life. The spiritual life is the way you live on earth. That's why all this talk about the body. And what we have called spirituality up to now is simply a defense against living the religious life. Boy, does this make theologians mad. Because they're all full of shit. All of this theological talk is an attempt to generalize the spirit and not here help each individual hear their task and fulfill it. And the fulfillment of that task becomes their worship. I'll bring you a quote next time where Jung talks about that. I don't want to misquote it because it's so beautifully said, but you're getting a sense of we've done a lot of work and now we're talking about, so how does this all come out in the wash? Well, this is how it comes out in the wash. Your sense of values changes. Your relationship to your instincts change, your understanding of what sacred is and your attempt to live the sacred life changes. And it looks at times so banal, but it's an offense to our egotism. And that's where people are vulnerable to the theologians. You get some grand fantasy, but you look at your life and you're doing absolutely nothing that you've been given to do. How this fits into the Sophia experience is that Sophia is one way you get there. It seems to be the way that's hitting more and more people, that the knowledge of the self comes through these physiological and morally complicated situations. I'm just going to mention this. We don't have to go into it, but just so you've heard it. In Aurora, about halfway down the page, the risen bridegroom stands at the left hand of the queen who appears to him in gilded clothing, surrounded with variety. That was in an earlier text. The queen, this figure, the queen of alchemy, is again wisdom. Blah, blah, blah. I just brought you along the closest picture I could find, which is this one from Rosarium, King and Queen. Pass it off you. The only relevance, I think, to our discussion immediately for this is how this image of the glorified body, if I can call it that, appears in dreams. It can appear as simple as a man and woman holding hands, if the woman is Sophia and if the man is the body.
So I want to make sure I understand the statement right below that about this figure being more deeply buried in the unconscious than the animal. Because we have
she stands to the right of the bridegroom, that is to say, he is more deeply buried in the unconscious than she, and is a figure of even stranger to consciousness than the animal. I think that's what I just explained. But can you make the leap? How is what that is saying what I just said?
Well, the man has access to his anima, but this idea of the sacredness of the body would be even more unconscious than that.
It's even stranger to really try to live life without spiritual fantasies and accept the demands that are being put on you to fulfill certain obligations, inner obligations in the outer world, and to fight for certain types of relationships. That idea that is spiritual is so foreign to us, it's tantamount to being further in the unconscious. You know, just again, it's a simple little silly thing even, but next time somebody says to you, oh, Jane or John is a spiritual person, ask them, why is that better than saying they're a material person? And you will hear all the things that we've been talking about, which are really embedded in the way we look at things, and they're false. It is something that is part of the fabric of our life, so much so that we don't even realize there's another way to conceive of it.
I've had occasion in a recent interview to ask a subject if he thought of himself as being a spiritual person or a religious person. And he said, well, I don't like the split between matter and spirit, so I think of myself as a religious person.
I bet I knew who that was. Do I know who that was?
I don't know. Wendell Berry?
That's what I thought it was. Yeah, I think these people are all, you know, they, if you listen to what I would call the cutting edge of our cultural leaders, in their own way, they are all coming out of this reassessment. I don't particularly care for his brand of how he responds to it, but I think they are trying to... his farm is sacred to him.
Yes, it is.
See what I mean? In contrast, speaking of France, when I got back, and that's why I love these French farmers, their farms are sacred to them. When I got back from the States, I took one of these SureRide limos, and I was sharing a ride with a guy from Omaha, Nebraska, who was telling me that their farms, oh, you're over in France, but they got small farms over there. We got big farms where I come from. Our farmers are 1,000 to 2,000 acres. You know what? We can put chemicals on that land, and we can get a yield better than any. That's not somebody for whom the farm is sacred.
Yeah.
That's somebody for whom that farm is an object.
Yes.
How about confinement farming? That's what they do.
I don't. Oh, you mean animals?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just trying to contrast how once you begin to realize what this thing is, you'll hear it in different places now. People who are trying to make their either simple or, I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but their what's in front of them, the thing that feeds them. And not try to make it bigger, not try to make it grander, not try to get richer off of it, but just to serve it. That's another implication of this material, I think. Everyone, I mean, there are people who take it politically, there are people who take it agriculturally. I think it gets very complicated when you try to live it out. But what we're trying to do is understand how there's a paradigm shift underneath the historical moment. Everyone's got their interpretation of it. You'll have to find yours, but what we can try to get to is the basic shift in images in the unconscious that are probably necessary for the survival of our species in the next period of history. This allows somebody to be small and to feel good about it. Franz Fanus used to say, most people are living by what she calls the PPFF lifestyle. Prestige, power, fame, and fortune. And this is something else. And it's an attempt to define that something else. And I make no apologies if it isn't clear, because it's an attempt to get beyond the old stuff. And it's probably a first attempt. Okay. Um, 370. For thou art, bottom of the page, for thou art she who shall enter through the ear. Remember, she is wisdom. Through my domain, and I shall be clothed with a purple garment from thee and from me. I will come forth as a bridegroom out of his bride chamber. Now here you begin to see the text expressing itself in language, which leads to theological implications. Pass around these. These are both pictures of the Annunciation.
For us heathens, that's when Gabriel came to Mary and said, "You're going to have the Savior."
Yeah, when the Holy Spirit, made Mary pregnant. And in these pictures, and in some traditions, he enters her through the ear.
Oh.
That's the point of these pictures.
I was asked about the ear businesses. This kind of purse here in your ear.
Well, it might not be separate from that archetypal image.
Hmm. Interesting.
Isn't that why they, in John, they call Christ the Word?
Wow. And it's the Word.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and the word comes in through the ear. And again, you'd be surprised how this appears in dreams. People conceiving through the ear. Or, yes, I had some dreams of my own like that. A bird flying in my ear. And I had on a, I don't know if you know, the northeast Switzerland's called, I forgot what is it, Appenzell. All the men wear earrings on the left ear. And I had an earring in my left ear like an Appenzell farmer, and a bird was flying through my ear. One of my very first dreams in therapy, 30 years ago. And I wouldn't have known it, but my analyst pointed out that is an image of the Annunciation. I think it's tradition, and you see it. I don't think it's biblical that I know of. I don't think anywhere it says in the Bible that the Holy Spirit entered through Mary's ear. But it's become a tradition, and you see it then in art. That's why I brought this. If you notice that the birds are flying towards her heart, but the trajectory of the lines are to her ear.
But the Holy Spirit talked to her, so that was when it came. That's in the text.
Yeah, right.
Talked to her, so it did enter.
Right. Now, here, I'll make you do some work. Look, how does the way the text describes the body receiving wisdom through the ear draw a parallel to this tradition, and what does that tell us about the implications of the Sophia, latter phase of the Sophia experience?
This tradition?
Coming forth as a bridegroom out of
no, in the Christian tradition, the bird going in through the ear is an annunciation. In the text, wisdom enters through the ear.
And was born flesh.
And, well, here it's born flesh.
Mm-hmm.
Here it enters through the ear, and he's clothed with a purple garment.
Holy.
Right. But what does that tell us about the way, let's say, Thomas's unconscious saw this phase of the process? Well, it's saying that this is the new annunciation.
I'm trying to make it harder than that.
Actually, it's actually quite hard. It means that that the individual becomes, each individual becomes Mary. And each individual has to receive the insight gained through the Sophia experience, and that is now how Christ continues to be born.
Is there, but it says, when the soul has entered the body and the bride has united with the bridegroom, does that mean then once you have been given the word, you have to act?
Absolutely.
Before you get the purple garment.
And in that action, you get the purple garment. And in that action, you are living the Christian story one step further.
So that is the second coming.
So that is the second coming. Our understanding, our life task, and living it is the second coming. That is the theological implication of this text. We started off talking about this, so I wanted to give you an overview. Now you see why I brought in the theological side, because the text starts using religious language for which traditionally had been used to express some of the key dimensions of Christianity for this very process of becoming conscious.
I saw a film last night of a priest giving a retreat on Paul, the letters of Paul. And the point that Fabio Jean was making was, Paul isn't calling you to dogma. He's calling you to have your own experience. If you have not experienced the risen Christ in whatever way that means in you, then you've missed the whole point of what this is about. So we were talking about how difficult that is for people to understand. Because those of us in the room were older, and how we've been told the church never says to use your imagination. Anything that comes to you that's outside of the text, you have to see as a sign of the devil. And what this priest is saying is, we need to go back and revisit those and look at what was really being said during that time. So whether you would agree with him or not, he has some pretty compelling.
What's his name?
Father Eugene.
So if I say Father Eugene, God's telling me to have sex with my neighbor. What do you think of that, Father Eugene? What do you say? She's married. She has four kids.
I don't know that he could take that large a leap.
This does, but it's a difference.
But I think it's phenomenal that a priest would even be saying to have his own experiences is not about dogma. I felt it was an amazing thing for me to hear a priest in a retreat telling people, you have to have your own experience of what that is. And this was Paul's, and he had to go away for 14 years to understand what it meant to him. You have to find your own way through it. I was stunned. I mean, we can interpret it all. Maybe he didn't go far enough.
It's like my Old Testament verse you see, everybody is for justice in theory. But when it comes down to the messy wet of it, I wonder where they...
But then he said, and then that was his next line, and he said, and you think once you get it that your life's going to be okay, he said, that's when the mess begins. This is what he was telling us in this English thing. Because that's when the mess begins. He said it's there.
Well, if he could stay true to that, he is definitely in line with this material.
Well, I guess my point is, even if he can't go to the leap we can make, I think it's stunning that anybody even within the church is having that kind of a conversation and hasn't been thrown out. Because that's never been something that Catholicism...
But if you probably traveled it too much, you probably would be thrown out. Most of them get...
My pastor was thrown out.
No, he was considered a heretic.
Well, he did get fired from being the head of St. Meinrad's because he refused to fire a woman theologian there who signed her name to a petition saying that women needed to be priests. And he couldn't do it, and they fired him. So, you know, how far he can go or can't go, I mean, that's not, to me, it's a bubbling up even in these other places, and how far anybody can take it is their own path.
It's sort of how far they're willing to take it.
How far they're willing
Because when you look at Matthew Pumps,
yeah.
He took
it too far. Yeah. Did
ever tell you the dream of the priest and the risen Christ?
Yeah. But some of them haven't heard.
He was actually a very nice guy. His first dream was that he was to witness the resurrection of Christ. And the crucified Christ was brought in a casket. The casket opened. Christ arose. She was a woman. And she wanted to make love. And he ran.
That's awesome.
Running is awesome?
No, not awesome. The fact that Christ came as a woman.
That's what we're talking about here.
Right. That's great.
And he terminated.
That is great.
Well, they ran. That's great. You go back. Okay.
Yeah.
What I thought when I read that when the Holy Spirit went in and then was born flesh, that would be the material side of which would then go along with, to me, what we're talking about.
Yeah, in other words, what I kind of explained at the very beginning that what this looks like, the taking of the divine and putting it into the way you live. And then I started to say, and that has religious implications. And I kind of just told you that. Now we're getting to the part of the text which justifies my telling you that. That the imagery is going to say that This work with Sophia is preparation for the second coming. And the second coming is the responsible action of each individual fulfilling the will of God, you might say. And the only difference is, and where I have trouble with standard theology, is that these things are very often announced in ways that are in violation of the old code. But rather than throwing them out, we need to have our radar realize that this experience, which ends with the Annunciation, so to speak, often start in ways that are horrific. And conventional religion, conventional theology, conventional morality sees these things and tries to get people away from it. And what we're alerted to is to help them hear how this could be the beginning of a religious experience. That's the difference, I think.
Gary, I just want a question on one of those pictures, the last one, where Gabriel's coming with the lilies or whatever. I mean, lilies are always kind of a sign of death, aren't they? That's why I kind of I had the Easter lilies. It's like,
I wanted to kind of go into that ear business to show you the parallelism between the text and Christian iconography, and how that then, these are the kind of texts that Jung would take to say we're dealing here with a transformation of God image, a transformation of the Christian drama, Christian myth, Christian religion, depending on your point of view, there's an attempt for that to occur in the unconscious of individuals. We extrapolate that, is that a harbinger for a larger change in the future? And so the adornment, the purple garment, purple, of course, being the color of the passion, purple garment being that spiritualized body. Spiritualized meaning that the physical world begins to carry a spiritual importance. Uh, 371. Am I going too fast? You with me? When the soul has entered the body, see there after the first paragraph. When the soul has entered the body, and the bride has united with the bridegroom, she adorns him with a purple garment and jewels, and then he goes on. For thou shalt adorn me about with shining and glittering, and he goes on and on and on. The very last line is the thing I want to look at. And adorn me with a crown of gold engraved with a sign of holiness. What's interesting is that the crown of gold, if we take it as an alchemical reference, when it appears in alchemy, very often that crown is on a worm.
On a what?
A worm.
What?
W-O-R-M.
Or snake.
A worm.
A worm.
I know, it doesn't make any sense. A worm is what receives the crown in alchemy. And thank you for your puzzlement, because it just shows how foreign this imagery is to common sense. Now, what would that mean? See, that puts him in the place of the worm. These experiences start in a worm state. When you feel low down and worthless. But the implication of the alchemical image, and again applying that to this text, is that is the highest experience. So that the Sophia experience, you could say, is a worm experience. You feel lowly like a worm. And we don't like feeling lowly like a worm. We like feeling PPFF.
Now, what do you think is the sign of holiness?
Oh, the crown.
But it's engraved with the sign of holiness.
Well, it's representative of the crown is wisdom.
See, when I read that, I saw a crescent moon.
See?
Because maybe even a combination of sun and moon together.
I'm not sure exactly what its specific configuration is, but it would represent what we've been calling the divine aspect of this experience, whether you call it a moon or a sun, the light of the sun and the moon. I think for this the distinguishing feature is that the high, which would be the insight, which would be the light of the sun and moon on that top of that peak there, that new illumination, what it illuminates isn't the frequent flyer club at the airport. It illuminates a worm. That's the ironic twist of the image. What are you thinking?
I'm going to have to puzzle on that worm thing for a while.
That would be a good bumper sticker.
Isn't that saying the same thing as that the gold is found in the donkey, you know?
Yeah, but I appreciate her reaction so much, because it shows you what an affront that is to common sense and good taste.
Yeah.
A worm! Yeah. I've been in analysis for 5 years, and I feel like a worm!
I don't think that I was... It just seemed like instead of just apples and oranges, now we're talking about worms.
It's like it's a different
language.
Yeah, and it doesn't make sense.
It's just a totally different image than, you know, it was like I was thinking of one thing and then you said a worm and what did you say?
But can you see how we've been talking about worm all the time in here?
Yeah.
It's just we never use such a graphic image. And you have the honesty to give us an honest emotional reaction of how, ridiculous this sounds. But it does seem ridiculous in this part of the experience. And we do not want that to be a characteristic of our life. But if you can't accept that as a characteristic of your life, you can never get to the synthesis that we're talking about. And everything in the PPF SUV cell phone world works against this. We're trained to be big shots. This experience is about being a low shot. And it's degrading. It's degrading.
Because you don't want to look at it as humbling, saying, I am more humble than you are because I am thinking of...
Yeah, that's using it as power.
Yeah.
I gave you a kind of a funny example. It just came to my mind. I remember when I was in Switzerland, one of our board of directors, who was a real sleazy guy, got busted investing quite a bit of money of the Jung Institute in the black market in either Taiwan or someplace. It was a nasty scandal. And I don't know if he had the sanctions of the other people or not, but he did it. And I made the comment, what a sleazebag. And the woman I was working with said, you know, if the self weren't interested in him, he wouldn't have gotten caught. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's a worm experience, getting busted. He was a prominent Zurich attorney, getting busted, losing, you know, students' money in a black market deal. And yet, somehow I would say, that's the kind of thing that people come to in therapy, you know, humiliated. And you could always ask yourself, why did this guy get caught and not somebody else? Well, if you think the world is not always meaningless, maybe there's a meaning to it. And that could be the beginning of this transformation if you know how to receive it for him. So I focused on this worm thing intentionally so you could see how unpleasant a part of this experience is. And yet, in the text, that is crowned with the highest value.
Now, what does the lily have in alchemy? What does that mean in alchemy?
That I don't know, actually.
Isn't that 326?
Oh, you're way ahead of us.
Okay.
But I would think it's... I think it's the same that this experience is aiming for resurrection.
I guess I was going to have the lily as death, didn't they? Where did they say that, where they hold a lily and it's, you know, they die? I don't know. Maybe both.
I think there's an image of a saint like that, showing her prostrate, just holding a lily.
Mm-hmm. That's all I just thought.
Yeah, but still makes sense.
And you, so his early mother goddesses, they're often holding lilies, yeah. too. I'm not aware that it would have any different meaning in alchemy than it does in Christianity. Okay, 372. At the second line, the coronation scene in our text, the bride clothes her lover with a purple garment. Okay, that's what we already did. 372, second line. Skip a little bit. In alchemy, this would mean the rubedo. That's why I brought this in. Another image for this phase. The reddening. Already referred to in the senior is one of these alchemists. Quotation in the fourth parable. He that shineth in color like a ruby through the tincturing soul which it hath acquired by virtue of the fire. I just mention this because reddening is one of the typical images of this phase in dreams. And where would you see that? What gets red? I hadn't thought of that. I don't think so. No, I was thinking the sunrise. You know, people will have a dream just seeing the sky beginning to redden. And you can think of this part of the process. So what we've got, of course, is, you know, is a very schematized process, and then we've got to learn, or not have to, but in my position, I need to know all the different mundane ways that would be personified in a dream. Okay. Going on to the bottom of 372, I'm just going to carry this a little further.
You know, this idea of the body, of the soul imparting color to the body,
mm-hmm.
that really gives me something to think about as far as my paintings go, because the body in each of the paintings changes colors. Mm-hmm. And it's as though, well, something is symbolized specifically with that certain color that the body is. It goes from red to blue to green.
We get more of that, Carol, at the bottom of the 372. According to the Gnostic Basilides, I think it's pronounced, the world soul is nothing but an emphasis, I saw a typo, emphasis or color of light which has descended into matter.
Of course.
Very last line on 372, halfway in, According to the Gnostic Basilides, the world soul is nothing but an emphasis or color of light which has descended into matter. As Philo puts it, it produces many colored fabric of the world. Now, that's just showing how this latter phase that we're talking about makes life colorful again. Because through a lot of the process, you were in a depression and feeling that everything was gray. But when you are able to take the insight and begin to live it, that is what brings color back to life. I think I've read you this quote. Let me just read it again from Picasso. Oh, no, sorry, from Van Gogh. I want to paint men and women. Remember that? With the touch of the eternal, whose symbol was once the halo which we tried to convey by the very radiance and vibrancy of our coloring. So the theological implication then is that what is sacred then is the colorfulness of your life. That was what was once projected in medieval times onto the holy and seen as a quality separate from the person, the halo above the head. And now it is a part of the vitality and color of life that we're trying to recreate when we live sacredly in time and space.
I wonder if the order of the colors that the figures come up would have a significance.
In your paintings? Make a note of that. Bring it in. I bet it does. I'd hate to try to generalize off the top of my head.
Yeah, well, I mean, can't imagine what it might signify. you know, the progression of the colors, I mean, you know, what that really means in reality.
What they're doing, they're just now giving different images for the garment. Another image is color. Because that's what they refer to the Neophytes giving a new heavenly garment. I'm just trying to touch on the main points because we have not exactly gotten through the book today. I know Mary gets great joy out of this, but...
But I'm glad you go slow because it's too hard.
Is it?
You
don't. Well, I just... Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. Let's see. Let's do one more thing and then we'll stop. This is what Carol had raised earlier. Let's go to 374. It does give us a good place to stop. It should be borne in mind. Go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 lines down. It should be borne in mind that throughout this part of the parable, the bride and bridegroom are winged beings. That's kind of what you were referring to, Carol. And winged beings, that is spirits, and that everything that happens between them takes place in heaven. That is, in the world beyond, the unconscious. The earth, the body, and earthly reality in general have been left behind like an empty grave. Therefore, the author no longer intervenes in the dialogue with interpolated comments. He has, as it were, vanished in the impassioned converse of wisdom and the glorified king. In the next paragraph, I think I can just summarize the basic idea is there, which is what we've said, that the change of clothing is a change, represents a change in attitude. So that the purple garment would represent the spiritualization of matter. And we're using two different phrases to mean almost the same thing. The materialization of the spirit and the spiritualization of matter. Materialization of the spirit is when that insight is brought down into life and lived, and materialization and the spiritualization of matter is when that your lifestyle is redirected through new understanding. And that's what the robing and the colors symbolize. But in Thomas's case, this is not happening in reality. It's only the appearance of the paradigm in his unconscious. That's why it's not a real body, but a winged body in the unconscious. The process is working whether or not anybody receives it. What we would try to do then, in Jung's mind, this is just an internally, spontaneously occurring sequence of psychological events, of a psychological development, and then we would try to plug that person into doing at each phase what is necessary to realize the meaning of that phase. But here we're just getting the paradigm without anybody really understanding it or actualizing it. But this was the 13th century. Does that make sense?
Well, okay, the dream you had about the bird flying in your ear was kind of saying that then, wasn't it?
That was the beginning of my training, that I would be receiving a new way of understanding, mm-hmm. and that I had to change the way I lived because of it, mm-hmm. and that was my sacred task. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Mm-hmm. And I had this earring, you know, left ring on the left ear, and these farmers in Appenzell are notorious free spirits. They do not. They're not company men by any means. They're kind of almost a little hoodlum-y. They're very small people and very feisty. If you go to, let's get some Appenzell cheese sometime, and they have it in that little cheese section. And have a bite of Swiss chutzpah, I guess you might say. But that was the personal development I had to develop, stop being a suck-up and develop that kind of independence of spirit that the Appenzell farmers represent. Yeah. Okay, well, that takes us to 374. We almost got through 10 pages. So it may be a couple more meetings. But I think we've got the main idea, so the chapter's going to keep repeating that. It's going to keep giving us different images of this spiritualization of matter and the materialization of the spirit. And it's going to continue looking at the theological implications of the imagery that his visions use to express this process. So we've got the basic argument down, and we'll just be rehashing. So it probably, hopefully, go a little faster than today. But I do feel it's important to look at how strange this is to our way of conceiving of things. And it's both psychological and it has religious implications. If you look at it, its imagery in the context of the way traditional imagery is generally used. Okay, thank you. See you in two at Nancy's place.